Hello and welcome to episode 16 of Matt D'Elia is Confused. I've been looking high and low for a guest to talk to about cults. Either a cult survivor or a cult expert or I don't know. But I definitely found the right guest to talk to about this. Her name is Toni Natale. And she is the former longtime girlfriend of Keith Raniere, the leader of the cult known as Nexium. Nexium has been in the news a lot these last couple years. Keith's name has been in the headlines nonstop. And if you know about Nexium, if you've read anything about it, you know that it's a sex cult. And it is it was a sex cult. But it was also much more than that. And it went on for decades. Before it ever turned into a crazy sex cult, it was, well, just a regular cult, if that's a thing. But Toni's story has everything you could ever want in a story about cults. And cults have always fascinated me, always confused me. And I was so excited to talk to Toni. Our conversation went great, and I'm excited for you guys to hear it. Here it is, my conversation with Toni Natale. Okay.
My name is Toni Natale. I am a survivor, a mom, a compassionate person when it comes to making sure that the truth comes out. And, you know, this whole process of has evolved from a point of, you know, just being a seeker, looking for someone that's looking for a better way in the world. And the way that it was presented to me in the early 90s by Keith Raniere, and what it turned out to be as the world watched in 2018 has been quite a trip.
Yeah. And obviously, so my listeners know you have a brand new book out about your experience called The Program, and I read it. And okay, here's the thing. I was already like so fascinated by this whole story. From his early days into Nexium, into DOS, which we'll get into the details of all that, but the framework with which you presented and your story sort of allows us a way in because it's, and I think I've heard you say this somewhere, but you know, you're not a Nexium survivor. You were never in Nexium. Your experience with Keith was sort of from the beginning. And it's, I mean, I hate to use it this way, but you know, with Joker out, there's like this supervillain origin story thing that's out there, and you kind of were there at a time when he went from possibly, in air quotes, normal businessman to madman. And I think the way that you get us in and sort of get into his mindset and your own. In terms of your own involvement, I just think it's a really unique and interesting way into this whole story. So you met Keith. What was the name? Consumer Byline? Was that what he was doing when you met him?
Yes, Consumer's Byline.
Correct. Okay, so Consumer's Byline. And that was, tell us what that was, and so we get a sense of where he was when you met him.
So I met him in the early 90s, and the thing that I like to preface with people is it was before the internet.
Right.
So where we're all used to having all of the answers literally in the palm of our hands today, that's not something that was available then. You know, you looked into somebody's eyes and you asked them a question, they answered it, and you hoped that they were telling you the truth.
Right.
So it was a consumers-based organization. It was a membership buying club, kind of like a Sam's or a BJ's or a Costco type of thing. And there was, you know, X amount was paid per month for this membership, and then you saved hundreds or thousands of dollars on your goods and services, depending on how much you used the membership. But the basic program, the Consumers Byline membership was good. It was Keith that was the problem.
Right.
And it grew to over 200,000 people at one point. So it was a huge organization. It was all across the United States. But he was a businessman, as you say.
Right.
What I met was a businessman who touted a 240 IQ, top three problem solvers in the world, triple grade graduate from RPI. Mm. And he, you know, and he presented this in a way that seemed legitimate, and you had no reason not really to believe that. The enablers that were with him then, some of them still with him at the end,
right,
were still there when he was arrested, helped him to perpetuate this lie. And it was almost like a snowball. So it started to roll with just a few people, and it kept going and going and going. And who doesn't want to meet the smartest man in the world? And mm-hmm. who doesn't want to learn something? We all, I think, want to be better people. We're put here to, I think innately humans are good. So we want to learn and we want to grow. And he presented it in a way that obviously over 200,000 people were involved and interested.
And the framework, I mean, it's interesting just to continue framing it a little bit. You mentioned his enablers, and we can get into them specifically later. But just in general, I think to my eye, it seems as though even if you meet the guy and he's just a businessman and he might have out there shit to say, however, he might, even if you're considering, well, is this guy up to no good? He still has this like cater of people around him who sort of validate what he says for you, and they all seem legitimate too, right?
Yes, very much so.
And that was true even when you met him in the beginning, right?
It was, and it's how we started it in the beginning. I mean, you had one of the women that were involved was from the DC family, Kafritz family. They're one of their socialites in the DC area. And then you had Karen Unterreiner, who was an actuary. It's not very many actuaries in the country. She's a brilliant, brilliant girl.
Yeah.
His dad was a top advertising salesman. There was another woman that was appointed by Reagan to help women with business. And again, this is 91. So it's all new. And one of the things Keith never considered later on, looking forward as a mission, as he claimed to be, was the internet and the ability for people to connect. But at that point, you faxed things back and forth to each other. You picked up the phone and you called each other.
Right.
So the trappings were there, and the product was good.
Right. So, okay, so he goes from Consumers Byline, mm-hmm. and then the transition from, I guess, to focus on the transition from a businessman in the eyes of not just his peers or anyone around him, but also the world. I mean, even when that went under and was in legal trouble, it was still a business. And you could say about him that he's a failed businessman or huckster or whatever, but you couldn't, there was nothing that smelled of cult yet, right?
No, right. Okay. He wasn't doing the enlightened being, I'm going to save you, self-help. It was a businessman. There was more men involved than there were women.
Mm.
And, you know, the meetings that we would have anywhere between 500 and 4,000 or 5,000 people in attendance,
huh,
all promoting this membership. So, as you say, yes, it was a failed business, but yet a business.
Right.
It wasn't a self-help group.
And as you point out in the book, something that I really, I think got a lot out of was when you sort of point to its concurrence with Nexium's, the beginning of Nexium's concurrence sort of with like the original self-help craze with Tony Robbins and things like that, that I think Keith saw an avenue towards as a businessman, you could even argue, well, that's where the money for a man like me really is. Is that right? I mean, he sort of like saw what Tony was doing, as you write, from what I understand, and was like,
yes,
how do I do that, right?
Yes, because when Consumers Byline closed and we started a health food business, he was not a dollar-sized as he was with Consumers Byline.
Mm.
So there wasn't even 50 people that were cheering his name. We were selling supplements,
right,
and working with myself with children with ADD, ADHD, and helping people with nutritional protocols. And the concept itself was great and would have been wonderful, but it wasn't giving him what he wanted. He wasn't the smartest man in the world. It wasn't his accolades that drew people in. It was the savings on the supplements.
Right.
And when he met Nancy, Nancy claimed to be number two NLP expert in the world. And he had seen what Tony Robbins did with his business mm-hmm. and what his growth was. And he saw this as his next in. It was his next. Keith replaced people. As people came in his life, he used them, and he used them for whatever his needs were to be able to further his own agenda. And when he was done with them, he would toss them aside. Mm. Nancy checked all the right boxes for him to be able to bring him to that next level.
So this is Nancy Salzman, right?
Yes.
Okay, so
yes.
Nancy Salzman. So, okay, so them coming together, as you point out, was sort of the beginning of the path towards true criminality and terror and all that stuff. So she enables him, he juices her for everything she's worth, not necessarily economically, but uses her skills and sort of folds them in to get where he wants to go. So if when that happens, like what, and you're at that point, I forget actually the timeline, but are you still, this is when you came back into Keith's life? Is that right? When they first get together?
I was still in Keith's life.
Okay.
I had not left.
Okay.
We were together. Nancy was brought into my health food business. She had a problem with constipation, so someone brought her in for. She's still full of shit. But, she needed some help. So she came in, and we sat down and we talked, and she said, "Thank you so much. I mean, this is amazing." And because Nancy had such a great reputation in the Capital Region and in the NLP, neuro-linguistic programming world, people knew who she was. We knew who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And Keith saw himself as an NLP expert. It's what he used, that and some sort of hypnosis. That's how I quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
He's the taking of the tests, the drawing people in. He's been working on perfecting this, I think, for decades. And when he found Nancy, she had that skill set, and she had the connection, she had the business acumen, she had the community. She was his next move.
Right.
So in meeting him, what they did was, Nancy had already developed a program that, in my opinion, is ESP or was ESP. EST turned out to be what she did on steroids. And
right.
He watched her do that presentation. That's all he needed to see.
Right. And that's Executive Success Programs. That's Keith's company, right?
Yes. Keith's, Nancy's.
Right. Place. Okay. Okay. Right. 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 Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I guess here's where I want to ask you in a much different way, you were sort of roped into Keith's life. He clearly, one of his, I don't know if you could call it a skill, but I guess it is a skill. I mean, he can ingratiate himself with people and get people to believe in him. People who aren't at all stupid, who aren't all anything really besides, I mean, ambitious sometimes comes to mind. Seekers, I think, is a word that mm-hmm. comes up often in the book. These are people who have minds. They're not just stupid falling in line and listening to somebody who says they know more. These are real thinking, smart, sometimes brilliant people. I think to an outsider, it's all we know is, well, I mean, you know, once the DOS stuff came to light, which we can get into later, but once that was out, everyone just thought, well, who the fuck would ever do what this guy says? He's clearly demented. And obviously he is demented, but I think that and I think you can speak to this, it leaves out, A, the long play of he didn't come up to anyone and say, hey, do this for me, do that for me. He sort of woos them and lies to them and does whatever he does. And I know it's over a long period of time, but what is that, the beginning of him sort of getting you on his side, what is that like? And I know you weren't there for when it happened to Nancy, but to a degree, it happened to you as well in a much different way. And obviously, on your end, you experienced it much differently. But still, there was that beginning of, what is the allure of a person like him, I guess? Well, how does he present that? Yeah.
I think with Keith, it's very simple. It's the same playbook, but different players. Mm-hmm. He has a very thin playbook from how he brings someone in, even to the verbiage that he uses, that I learned later in sitting through the trial, and his legal litigation. Everything is very much the same, because why not? It's worked all these years. Mm-hmm. So him drawing him, when I got involved with him, he listens.
Right.
He listens and he hears everything and he waits. He waits for that crack in the plate. Mm-hmm. He waits to hear, where is that soft spot? Or where is your strength? Because what he does draw in is, when people say, oh, these people are so stupid.
Right.
They're not. They're really bright people, and they're producers. They're hard workers. He's lazy. Keith is lazy. So he wants someone that's going to do the work for him. And over the years, as people have left ESP, Nexium, whatever next organization he created and put out there, and they would find me, what I came to learn was what they thought was so wonderful in him was really what was wonderful in them. Mm-hmm. And he has an ability to be able to draw that out of you and then kind of kick it back to you, like you're learning something for the first time, but really you're coming to the table with that.
Right.
That's not someone that's stupid. That's just someone that's trying to, or believing that they're going to a mentor that knows better, that can teach them. I mean, after we split up, what he became, which was just hysterical to me, was a renunciant. And that he had no need for material matter, and he was celibate, which was absolutely an insane thought.
Right.
And the way that he was able to propagate that is, what the Eastern District did when they presented the trial was they presented the inner circle. And in the book, there's a photograph of all the people that were in the inner circle. Mm-hmm. Those people held his secret safe. Now, not all of them knew all of the other parts, but in the very beginning, enough of them knew enough. And then they just kind of built this fortress around him, so that if you had a question or if you balked at something, someone would come in and say, oh, yeah, no, he's the smartest man in the world. You have to believe, you have to trust. And these were big names in their own right.
Right.
I mean, the ex-president of Mexico's son, Emiliano Salinas. You know, so the people that he brought in to do his bidding for him had in their own rights their own group of people that look to them. So by the time you got to Keith in his new version of himself, you had gone through so many classes and been EM'd, programmed, talked to, bowed. I mean, they condition you right from the very beginning with the handshakes and the scarves and the bowing to the pictures this is our vanguard. This is our prefect, Nancy Salzman.
Right. And it starts as a self-help company. I mean, that's what it's billed as. Nexium is for self-help. And so people are going and they're getting results. I mean, right? Like I've seen testimonials, people really did swear by it to that it improved their lives, their outlook, their mood. I mean, clearly he had to have gotten some kinds of early results to get new members, but also to create scenarios where people would do anything for him, right? I mean, there was an element where at least the early returns on, I don't know, mood were working, right? I mean, there was something that was working. Is that right?
Sure. I mean, you know, the fact that he took concepts from other things and mashed them all up and then called them executive success program. So even the term itself gives you a feel of, if you want to succeed in business or be successful in life, this is where you want to go.
Right.
And if you took a 5-day or even if you took a longer program and didn't get involved in the minutiae, you took the coursework and you went on. I think they said like 14,000 people went through the program.
Wow.
So if 14,000 people went through and 5% of the population susceptible to hypnotic induction or, you know, more of this type of a thing. He's very, very patient. He just waits and distills down and waits and distills down, and has at this point now perfected through classwork and breakout groups and information that they get from people, very personal information that they get from people. So he's able to know who he can target through his own, through the other coaches or proctors. But the classes themselves are structured in a way to expose you to anything that's ever happened to you as a child or an adult. Mm-hmm. So you're open. So now someone that's earnest and really cares is going to help you build back up.
Right.
Someone like Keith is going to help you break that down.
Right. One thing I did sort of, two things, I guess. I mean, one, and it sort of speaks to what you're saying right now, is that it's very, there are a lot of tenets of what he was about and what he was espousing that were very similar to Scientology. And I guess it might be immaterial to even bother asking, but was this like a conscious effort? Was he not even aware of what he was up to, do you think? Or do you think he was saying, I want to create this sort of army of people who will do exactly what I say, believe exactly what I say? Or do you think it was more this as sort of the victims of NXIVM would say, it's this sort of slower developing thing where one thing leads to another and then suddenly he's this evil person? Or do you think that was his actual, what he was seeking was this sort of ultimate goal of building this cult institution type of thing? Because, I mean, it's so similar to Scientology in certain areas. I find it almost hard to believe that it wasn't by design, you know?
Okay, so let me digress. Yeah. My mom used to say that in order for him to be with you, Tony, he had to be normal. So
right.
When Keith and I were together, he presented as normal, you know, as you do the air quotes, normal as you could be, because in order to be in a relationship with me, that's what he had to show me, and that's what he showed to the world. And he did that as long as he could until he couldn't do it any longer, until he found a replacement because he needed someone else to enable him into his next project. And he was very aware of Scientology and reading about it and Ayn Rand and that type of philosophy. And he wanted that. Keith is very deliberate in everything he does. And he's 5 or 10 steps ahead of wherever anyone else thinks he is.
Mm-hmm.
He missed a few steps here, but you know, I think that what happened is as he got away, we all have moral compasses.
Yeah.
So where's our line in the sand? So as he got each one of these people to push the line, like any psychopath, he escalates. And he'd escalate a little more. And then he'd get somebody to do the next thing. And then they'd escalate a little more.
Right.
And the whole premise of some of the EMs and some of the things, even before he had Executive Success Program, just getting people to tell him all of their secrets, all of the things that bother him, because he's going to help you through this. And then he uses it against you.
Yeah.
So I think it's...
I mean, that's exactly, again, it's exactly what we hear from the stories of people who escape from Scientology. It's the same thing where it's they get you to tell them things that you would never really tell, or in Keith's case, I mean, actual collateral where, you know, if you leave, let's talk about that a little bit, actually. So your experience was when you left him, one thing I wanted to ask you about was his complete unremitting will to not let you, even you, get away. I mean, you weren't someone who was in NXIVM. It was just before that, right? So you're, I'm confused why he doesn't just let you get away, because eventually, and it ended up being true, it fucked him over to be someone who was unrelenting in their pursuit of not letting others get away.
It's the million-dollar question, because I think that if he can't possess you, he has to destroy you.
Yeah.
And because he gave me, in his view, a position that he has not given to anyone prior or since.
Right.
I mean, we had a home and we were raising my son together, and like, you know, he had the normal. I am now very clear that there was a lot of things going on while we were together, and he was presenting this, not to the extent of where he. Again, he escalated, not to the extent of where he was, but there were enough red flags that I should have been more aware. But you see what you want to see,
right?
And you believe what you want to believe. And when I just couldn't, you know, it was just too clear that there were things that were never going to jive with my life, just let me go.
Yeah.
But there was no letting me go. I mean, he created a module about me called The Fall. You know, you see in the book the death timeline about how my life, and there's two of them. I have the first death timeline, first yeah. timeline in there. Just obsessive because no one leaves Keith.
Yeah.
You know, they just don't leave. And had he let me go, I don't know. I don't know if a lot of this would have transpired. Because
right.
even the Forbes article, the first Forbes article that was written was 2003. And Michael Friedman was doing a story on executive coaching. And every time he Googled Keith's name, my name would come up with my bankruptcy pleading.
Right.
And he went and looked at the files and what my mother lovingly referred to as the crazy letters, the gaslighting letters.
Yeah.
All the gaslighting letters were in my bankruptcy file.
Oh.
So he came to talk to that, right? And he's like, what is up with this guy?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's exposing himself in a way that it seems so unnecessary, and at least played at least a role in his downfall, at least hurrying it up. I mean, there's no way to look at that kind of behavior of not letting people get away, even when he can afford to let them get away. It just ended up blowing up in his face to a large degree. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit more about the inner circle, because I think that plays into sort of Nexium sort of ramping up. And the inner circle, because he had that from since before you even met him. Mm-hmm. And those are the same people that sort of were his minions in coming after you, making your life a living hell, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're sort of perpetuating the myth of Keith as Nexium gets started. And it's having some degree of success, and I know this is when you're already gone at this point, but when does it start to, in your mind, when does it start to become like a full-on what most people would call a cult? Is that from the beginning? Because when does it make that transition from like, this is helping people, even if he does have this manipulation about people behind the scenes, he's a terrible person, there are still people getting results, but when does it cross that threshold into this is only dangerous for anyone who even steps into the ring here?
I my own personal opinion is it's dangerous from day one.
Right.
I mean, the concept and the for someone to elicit almost on a therapeutic level things from you that are really deeply rooted, because he had the ability to be able to elicit that through questions or programming or the coursework, is, and it's why I left. I mean, I went through the pilot program, so I went through the mm-hmm. first ESP coursework,
mm-hmm.
and for me, what I saw scared the shit out of me.
Right.
It was because I had so many. What Nancy called therapy. I had so many sessions with Nancy Salzman, mm-hmm. prefect, during the time where they were creating this, that what I saw within those courses was the things that I was experiencing in my therapy, in right. my sessions with Nancy.
Right.
And I went, oh, like this isn't good on any level.
Yeah.
So, you know, the hands and the knife of a surgeon is a scalpel, but the hands and the knife of a murderer is a murder weapon.
Right, yeah.
And I think that maybe there was some good in, as they call it, the tech. Yes, because they stole it from a million different sources.
Right, yeah.
But what was the overall purpose? Well, it was to elicit the first collateral. It started with just questions and answers of things that you were sharing that you didn't want to share with, you wouldn't want to share with someone else.
Right.
And then grew.
he has this way. I mean, I went down the rabbit hole on some videos of him, and I believe it was Allison Mack and some other guy. There's like, they're almost these like infomercials for Nexium that are still online somehow. It's like the greatest gift. I just want to keep watching it. It's like impossible to not look at this. But the very first video I watched is fascinating because your book, time and time again, would underscore this thing that he does. And I think it's a tactic of any kind of deeply twisted manipulator. And it's almost like the first thing on their agenda is to frame expertise as a bullshit thing. And if expertise is a bullshit thing, then anything can be true or best. And if that's the case, why not my thing? Like he there's this line that he talks about, he makes like some joke about how he has the best credentials, even though he has no credentials. Right. And he's framing it as like, well, if you went to all these other doctors and they have the best credentials and what they did didn't work, then I'm obviously the best option. And that's so deeply flawed, but I think it really grabs you. And I think that therein lies almost the magic of the cult leader, because it's like they're framing the other things you've tried as bullshit and that they're not going to work. And if they didn't work, then just even the credential giving apparatus might be bullshit. And if that's bullshit, then everything might be bullshit. And if everything's bullshit, then you can just listen to me, because look at all these people who agree with me. And he does that in so many ways. And I think that is probably, if we want to call it a skill, that's probably the skill that led him to getting people to tell him this shit, right? I mean, because as you just said, these are things people don't want to tell people. These are things we don't want to give people nude photos of us just because this is something we understand as collateral, as in if it gets out into the world, that would be bad. So to get someone to even open up to him or Nancy at all, it's almost like this bait and switch of like, the world out there is full of lies and bullshit, which, again, I wouldn't even argue that that's not true, but I would include Keith in that group. You know, he's bullshit too, and anyone who says they have the answer is bullshit. But I think if you've already arrived to say something that is ostensibly for self-help, you're someone who wants to be helped, and to prey on that it's like the bread and butter of the cult leader, you know?
Yes. And you're being presented with the smartest man in the world and Nancy Salzman, who's the prefect and the NLP expert. And then you have the Brothmans, the heiresses from the Seagram's fortune, and Sir Richard Branson, whose island they use, and the Dalai Lama that they brought in. So, you know, you have a lot of gets here.
People
look past the crazy. And they don't get to see. It wasn't until 2009 when a wave of women left and they contacted me that I realized how we got from where I had last seen him to 2009. I went to meet with them in a house, and they were up in this house, and there was a large television screen. There was this video playing, and they were all watching this video, and I said, Who is that? Who are you watching? And they said, Keith. And I said, Keith who? Because the Keith that you see on the cover of the book is who they were watching. The last Keith that I saw was inside the photos.
Right.
So he had gone to this place where he really did believe that he was Jesus or some facsimile of that.
Mm-hmm.
And It was a little frightening. It was all right. But you didn't get to that unless you went to Vanguard Week.
Right.
So, which is a 10-day celebration of his birth, in case anyone's interested. If you want it, send him gifts. August 26th. I'm August sure he could 26th. Use something in his commissary.
Yeah, that's the same birthday as a particularly bad ex-girlfriend of mine. So maybe it's that day. If you're born on that day, then you should avoid all people born on August 26th. But Vanguard – okay, so the Vanguard thing, the prefect thing, you've mentioned that. I want to talk about that a little bit. That wasn't – tell me if I'm wrong, but that wasn't when you were around, when he was insisting on being called Vanguard, correct?
That's, that, That's when they started.
Okay.
That's what they started, and that's when I went, yeah, no, I'm not going to calm Vanguard, and I'm going to leave now.
Right, yeah, that is...
right, like, I'm done.
Yeah, I mean, that is the ultimate sign when someone asks you to call them that. So, okay, he's now... You leave, he's now calling himself Vanguard. Nancy is his prefect, and do people... I mean, maybe you don't know because you're already gone, but do people who have already been with him to this point, are they... at all doing what you're doing, as far as you know, thinking, is this going too far? Because I think the long play progression makes sense to me, but let's put it this way. Even if my brother, who I love more than anyone, asked me to call him Vanguard, I'd say, go fuck yourself. And,
right.
I'm trying to be as understanding of someone who could fall victim to this as I can, but there are parts that don't allow me to do that. And one of them right. Is my teacher or coach or whoever it is asking me, someone who I'm paying to help me, asking me to call them Vanguard or Prefect. Can you talk about that a little bit? Was that like, was that just another thing that happened and it was just building on itself?
So that the audience understands, I didn't just leave. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, I'm going to pack up and go. My house was broken into. They stole my mail. They shut off my electric. I mean, I was gaslit to the point where I couldn't see straight. So it was more of a run for your life than it was break up with your boyfriend.
And it wasn't, it was because you weren't quote unquote cooperating with Keith
right.
as he exactly right. wanted and said he needed. You were doing what one does, which is live their own life. And when someone asks ridiculous things of you, you don't do them. And they right. were pushing you, doing actually genuinely disturbing and illegal shit. And you literally basically escaped in the middle of the night, right?
Right. I mean, they put a virus in my computer. They wiped out my business. There was no... You know, there's no breaking up with Keith.
Right.
So when you say how do people move into that in that next phase, I mean, I watched from a distance because they were dragging me through court. So I was in litigation with him for 8.5 years for my bankruptcy. So these people that were at one point, quote unquote, my friends, and that were the enablers that in some cases were with him, those that did not pass already to the end, there was just constant litigation.
Yeah.
And I would watch and think, how are these other people? How is it that they don't see this crazy man?
Right.
He did very well with isolating himself from anything else. It was through edification through another person. He didn't come up to you and say, call me Vanguard.
Right.
He would have whoever was, like you say, your brother. So you mentioned that your brother, if he asked you to do anything like that, you tell him to go fuck himself.
Yeah.
But you'd listen to him, wouldn't you?
Sure, yeah.
So if he could get you to listen and he could convince you and maybe bring you in and they could convince you in a 5-day, or you'd get just some good things out of it and go, okay, so that's not so bad. And the Vanguard part is like you call somebody sensei and
right,
the scarves are like a black belt because that's the way they present it. So they make plausible deniability for so many things. And
right.
you go, well, you know, okay. And that's kind of how he does things. The best lies have a little grain of truth in them.
Right.
So this is how he presents. Well, yes, you do call someone a sensei and you bow to them and you do wear a scarf. So, and their pictures are on the wall.
Right. And so you're right. Not you, but someone is bending here, bending there, making concessions, saying, well, it's not. And then next thing they know, they've given up either information or whatever it might be that they shouldn't have in retrospect. And now Keith and, you know, his minions have something on you and you can't leave. And I'm assuming at that point for people who are still in it and then considering leaving, they're doing some kind of mental gymnastics where it's like, well, they know best. Maybe there's been a little bit of results and their lives have been benefited in some areas. So they think, well, I guess I'll just keep going with it. And then that is sort of where it starts to get really ugly because you're starting to think, well, the walls are closing in and this is weird, but I'm going to stay and stay committed and not blow up my life or whatever. And so then these people are in there for 1, 2, 3 years. Because I feel like at a certain point, it gets to this place of you're someone is, it's like the micro decisions as it goes, and we're sort of putting blinders on as our lives move forward to the things that are really out of whack or out of place or unsafe feeling. And if someone's asking you to call them Vanguard and you're already so deep into this thing, then getting out of it, as you can easily attest, is a fucking nightmare. So it's almost like it benefits you to be able to put those blinders on. It benefits you in the short term. Your life doesn't have to be blown up. You don't have to get this litigation, nonstop litigation. You know, you can at least stay in the shell that you've created, and there's no immediate danger to your life. Although, if you try to go anywhere, then you're fucked. It creates this like horrible existential jail that these people are sort of in. So even if they are thinking, oh, this is getting weird, it's the incentive to leave isn't, it's not so clear. It's not like you can just go and then that's the last and your hands are, you know, clean and that's, you're done. There's so much shit to deal with. And I'm assuming they all know about you, right? And people like you who've maybe tried to leave, and that's the last thing they want to subject themselves to.
Right. Because it would be put out. I mean, one of the girls in the trial said, you know, what's the worst thing that could possibly, one of the witnesses, what's the worst thing that could possibly happen? She said, well, you'd be labeled a suppressive.
Right.
And she said, well, what's a suppressive? And she's a little horrible person. No one wants to be a suppressive. And she said, do you know any suppressives? She said, yes, one. Hmm. Have you heard of one? And she says, yes. And she said, who is that? And she said, Tony Natale. I've never met this girl. She was in her 20s.
Yeah.
When she, I mean, it just crazy things. So they use that as a flag. And I think for some people that went through executive success, ESP, Nexium, that were not tied to Albany, their experiences were different. Mm. The people that were tied to Albany, or the people, you know, the joke was everyone moves to Albany. Uh-huh. Once someone hooks you to move to Albany, you're going down a very different path than you are if you're going to a center someplace else.
Right, a chapter somewhere else. Right. If you're there with Keith, around Keith, then you're too far gone for any. Yeah, okay.
Well, he knows if he has somehow figured out through whomever a way to bring you there, he knows that you're someone that he can keep pushing that line with. Mm-hmm. You know, moving that line in the sand to see how far he can get you to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that point, you don't just leave a cult. Because when you leave, you lose most likely your financial, mm-hmm. your friends, your what you call your family, your day-to-day existence. It's not just breaking up with a boyfriend. It's blowing up your life.
Yeah.
And then how many lives did you bring into that while you were drinking the Kool-Aid and saying, this is so wonderful?
Yeah.
When you have your aha moment, thank God. But what about the people that you brought in that haven't yet?
Yeah.
And I watched some amazing people that left in this last blow up talk to people for hours and explain to them and be passionate and just heartbroken over the fact that they felt that they brought him into something that they internally believed was good until they saw it for what it was. One of the things Keith does better than anyone I've ever seen in my life is compartmentalize. So his ability to have someone literally standing next to each other and one not knowing what the other is doing stayed pretty well with it up until he was caught here.
Yeah, I mean, what a high wire juggling act. I mean, he kept so many secrets even from those among his inner circle. And I guess now would be the time to get into his fucking insane sex stuff, which is legitimately crazy. I mean, that's the stuff that like made people for maybe this is a lazy way to put it, but it seems like it's the thing that made people care. Like that was once that sex slave DOS thing broke, then people were like, oh, this is a fucked up thing, which to me in itself is fucked up because it was fucked up for like 15 years before that. Clearly.
I agree, Matt.
And so they're just, these people just want to fucking read about sex. And that's what like leads them to finally being outed. It's almost double disturbing to me. But that being said, it is sort of what ended up being the sign of his demise once all of this DOS stuff came out. So why don't you just tell us what DOS is in its offshootness of Nexium and all that stuff.
So what happens with Keith is he starts off with Executive Success Program and then NXIVM, and then he created different programs. There was the Source, if you were into acting, and there was SOP, Society of Protectors, the men's group. Mm-hmm. Then there was another group called Jeunesse, which was a women's group for women only, developed by a man, and that itself should have just said, somebody should have said, what's going on here?
It's assigned to run, yeah.
Yeah, XOSO. I mean, he created, which is yoga and things. So he created all these different entities, the Knife Media. So again, go back to that controlling all of your experiences. He realized people needed this external input, so he created entities so that the only information they were getting was the information he wanted them to get.
Right.
And DOS was created as, you know, a women, again, another women's only group. It was supposed to be a secret sorority type of thing. And it's my opinion that because we as a society, we've desensitized a lot of things just by what we see every day and what we experience, that he takes those things like 50 Shades of Grey and mm-hmm. he uses them to yeah. create his next thing. I'm grateful watching Handmaid's Tale that he's in prison.
Yeah.
Because I watch that and I think, wow, what would he do with that? Because
he's just pulling from the worst possible shit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when he created the DOS society, it was the same type of thing. And seeing how far he could push. So he had his core first line slaves that he convinced to be able to bring these women in, and then ran them. And you can't go branding people. You can't brand your initials on people's bodies.
You can't do that.
It finally was the tipping point. And you're right. It is a little sad that it took that, something that disturbing, to wake people up.
Yeah.
Because it was not for lack of trying to say that this man is dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, when I read about it, when the world read about it, and I just thought it was a sex cult until for a while, you know? And then when I finally started doing my homework, I was like, this is not a fucking sex cult. The sex cult was like the icing on the cake. It was a long-running cult that destroyed hundreds and hundreds of people's lives.
Yes.
And I think people maybe still don't know that. I think they still think of it as like this Hollywood sex cult. And it was neither one of those things, not Hollywood nor sex. I mean, and both of those things were certainly touched upon and had played a role. But this was going on in Albany and had nothing to do with sex for decades before the world knew about it and now knows about it as a sex cult. So DOS is... He had his inner circle be these master slaves who would go out within the NXIVM group and select slaves for themselves to be their masters, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And then they would have the meetings. I'm still a little bit confused as to Keith was running it and in secret, right? And that was like the big thing. It was supposed to be just among the women in NXIVM, but in reality, these masters were actually just reporting to Keith. Is that right?
Yes. His first line slaves knew that it was him.
Right.
It was the slaves that they brought in that until they were given their instructions to go seduce Keith, or photos. So as they got further along, they would eventually, some of them, find out that it was, in fact, Keith behind it. But for many of them, they didn't know. They really thought it was, you know, women-only type of an organization. But his core, his first-line slaves, not only knew what was going on, they were helping him. And so the women that they brought in, they were already, some of them had been in NXIVM for years, the Jeunesse program. So they were already... It was already established that they would listen to a certain way or give collateral to a certain extent or behave in a certain manner. So he knew who to tap, and he would send them out to get who he felt that, you know, would please him.
What a fucking piece of shit. I mean, reading your book, it's just like, wow. wow, this fucking guy is just like the biggest piece of shit there is. It's unfucking believable. It's insatiable. His piece of shitness, his appetite for piece of shitness is insatiable. It's just never ending. And I'm curious as to what, cause you talk, I think is super interesting in the book about how once that sort of initial group of insiders, his sort of inner harem, right? Inner sanctum, once they sort of either got out, went away, or some of them died, once they're gone is sort of when the thin veil that was covering up his darkest, darkest desires were sort of unleashed on Nexium, right?
Yes.
And I'm curious, I mean, you talk about this a little bit in terms of Nancy in the book, but what's hard for me is I think, okay, well, Keith obviously put that guy in jail until he takes his last breath. And it becomes this sort of like sliding scale of how much I've somehow arbitrarily perhaps decided that some people were implicit. The closer they got to Keith, the more guilty they are, really. And I'm curious as to what I think of everyone under his thumb as a victim, but at the same time, some of these people were just as bad as he was. And so where does that end, this sort of the guilt? I know, do you know what I'm saying? Like there's a gray line as we move further and further down the line of who was really deserving of punishment and who was a true, true victim.
Well, okay. So I don't know. The long term for this is to work with legislators and change what we see as a guilt in a coercive relationship, because coercive control is a real thing.
Right.
And it happens on every level, from a marital relationship to academia and business in a cult. It happens. And where is that line? Our legal system is so black and white in its definition of, you know, what the law is, and then you broke the law, and what your time should be, that we don't have a middle ground or a safe place or something for someone that needs help. Mm-hmm. They don't need to be incarcerated. They legitimately need help.
Right.
We have, as a society, at this point, we don't have anything like that. There's just, and it's, you say, like, who should be held responsible for what? Nancy Salzman should be right standing next to Keith as they take each last breath with each other.
Mm-hmm.
She is definitively was well aware of what she was doing, very capable, very complicit. There's no pass for me for Nancy because I saw the before, I saw the start, and then I saw what it turned into. And bringing in her own daughter into this thing, I just don't get it. And there's people that we'll probably never know what they did to skirt the law, but there's people that were there from the beginning that were very complicit in helping him to do things that seemingly nothing's going to happen to them.
Well,
other than the fact that the last 20 or 30 years of their lives have been destroyed by this man, which maybe in itself is enough. I don't know.
Right,
but I just... I don't know. I was hoping for yet another round, possibly in the Northern District of New York, who let the ball drop so many times that it's just flat as a pancake. Mm. They had a dozen different opportunities to stop him, and yet, you know, money buys a lot of power. So a lot of blind eyes were turned.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big takeaway from the book. I think it's such an old story. You hear about it so much, and it's still so true that if you have money, you can really, you might not get away with everything, but you'll seem like you're getting away with it for much longer than if you didn't have money. I mean, Keith's protection is in his, almost solely in his money because of the Bronfman, heiresses, the money that they have, that they can attack anyone, yourself included, who might cross them or come out against them. That money it's more than a buffer. It's like a, it's like a,
weapon.
It's a shield. Yeah, exactly. It's, they wield it, they use it to protect themselves. And it, and it's not just the lawsuits that they can sick on other people, but as you say, it buys actual influence. And it can, if you're, there's, you outline a few ways in the book about how the money sort of allows them to perpetuate what they're doing really without any interference at all, minus maybe a bad story in Forbes in 2003. But after that, it went on for how many years? It still went on for 15 more years unabated, you know, or it got worse actually.
Yes. I mean, in 2012, when the Albany Times Union did that amazing piece,
yeah,
nothing happened. And how does that, what happened? They came after the people that helped give the information for the story. I mean, it's just the political connections that run. Albany's a cesspool.
Yeah.
And they were able to buy their power there to the point where nothing was done, and very much should have been a dozen different times, or stopped.
Yeah.
I mean, the litigation, if you don't care what the outcome is, you can sue someone because you don't care whether you win or lose.
Right.
Because if you lose, then you just appeal. And the person on the other hand, on the other side of it, has to defend yourself.
Right.
You have to defend yourself as if you're being persecuted. And you would have thought that at some point in Albany, they would have seen this pattern that was happening over and over and over again that was connected to this group and done something. But, you know,
it's really hard to believe how long it takes to stop something like this. And I think it's a little, or it's very telling, I think, that a cult now can have the avenue to success for a cult is almost, it's hiding behind or enveloped in this sort of self-help business acumen thing, improving the self, gaining mm-hmm. success. I mean, executive success programs. It's all sort of under the same banner. It's not like this is why we're here. There's not an origin story of humans. It's not like, you know, Christianity. Those are not the kinds of cults that are really primed to blow up anymore because, I mean, I think that now the only way it can really catch fire is under the cloak of this businessy self-help thing where, you know, a guru figure can emerge and sort of, I think it speaks to the sort of like the time of now that a cult can emerge from this cocoon of like self-help, you know, it's very, telling, I think.
Well, because that's yeah. what people are interested in right now.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, and if things turn, someone that has a mindset like Keith will, you know, they'll find how they can maneuver their way into the next best thing.
Yeah.
And there's always someone out there, sadly, that wants to take advantage of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you go for people that, like I said, these are a lot of the people that were involved in this organization were wonderful people, mm-hmm. just looking for a better way to do things.
Yeah.
And taking advantage of them, someone that's a psychopath like Keith. Thankfully, I don't think there's a lot of Keith Raniere's in the world.
Yeah.
But if he was the only one and he was in jail, I'd have nothing to, I would be done.
Right.
Because there'd be no reason to educate people.
Right.
But when you say to someone that it's a cult, people that, you know, everyone has a vision of what a cult looks like to them.
Yeah.
These were very normal looking people. Mm-hmm. These are very normal everyday people. So how does this happen? It's slow. It's a slow indoctrination. It's one step at a, it's love bombing in the beginning. We love you. We love you. We love you. You're our everything. Then they draw you in. Then they build you up, then they break you down, and they rebuild you into what they want you to be.
Yeah, I mean, very well put. I find it, I think sometimes when I, because I've long been fascinated by cults and sort of not so much the leaders, but really the those who join and subscribe mm-hmm. and sort of perpetuate it out into the world. And I find myself in conversation and sometimes argument where there are people who have never, you know, subscribed or come close to even joining a group like this, maybe because they've mm-hmm. never had the opportunity. But I think that there's this common idea that how, again, it's sort of what we talked about before, is like, how could you be so stupid or naive? But I, all I think is, I'm not sure I know anyone who would out of hand reject every single thing like this. Like, right. People want to feel better. People are lost and people are sad. And if you can present either a system or a belief system or a way of doing things that even just at work or a self-help thing that other people say works or even might work, Keith is preying on this need that so many have, which is, I'm lost and I want to feel better, you know?
Right.
And I think that people are, when I think of the believers in things like this, I have great sympathy, empathy, understanding, I feel like. But when I, in Nexium, what I find maybe most disturbing is that it's really not just Keith doing terrible things. There's a lot of people, again, at various levels, just doing really, really on their face, out of hand, dark, terrible shit. I mean, even just, even, not even you, but there are excerpts in your book about what these people were, even just their letters to you are like, they're fucking demented. And that's early on, you know, you have to imagine the kind of pressure that was being put on these people later on if they threatened to leave, you know?
Right, because he got better at it.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
And the parallel sitting in that trial and knowing what I was experiencing and then listening to witnesses as they're going through the years and I'm comparing, and I thought to myself, my God, he was just relentless with everyone. Mm-hmm. It was just beating people, getting them to submit, breaking them down. And again, the hard thing for me to fold was I sat in the trial and I said, I have survivor's guilt in some respects, because as horrible as what he did to me for the last 20 years, I felt like, what didn't I say clear enough? Why didn't anyone listen?
Yeah.
Why couldn't this have been stopped before? And as you pointed out, it's sad. I mean, I can't ask you, tell you how many people have asked me if I was branded.
Yeah.
And I'm like, go read and call me back.
Yeah.
Because it was the tipping point. But, you know, kind of thank God, because I believe that I call it the Princess Diana concept. Keith needed to change the narrative. The media was catching up with him, even as many times as he changed his names, because that's what cults do. They change their names so that the media can't, you know, you can't follow them on the internet.
Right.
Nexium is a very difficult thing to Google.
Yeah.
You can now, but think about when he made that transition.
Yeah.
It was right after two suicides. So, you know, he was trying desperately to cover his tracks. And I don't know, I don't know if he's, I think he was born this way.
Yeah.
And hopefully there's very few people that are like this, that are so demented. But when he was on the run and he wasn't caught yet, I was really afraid that he would convince one of these girls that was still very much indoctrinated to take their own lives.
Yeah.
In a public kind of way.
Yeah.
So that he could point the finger, because that's what he does, and say, see what those detractors did, see what the media did, see what they did.
Right, yeah.
And change the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, even as you illustrate in the book, you know, the moment that the authorities do get him, when he's in Mexico, right? I mean, he's like a criminal from the movies. He's hiding out in Mexico, and he's got his harem of people around him. And I think one thing we didn't talk about was this. I think, you know, what people, if they know anything about Nexium, it's sort of the manipulation and sort of abuse of women. But there was this weirdly, which I didn't know actually until I read your book, because I always wondered, what the fuck were the men doing this whole time? Like, I understand what, I mean, there's so much literature now on available about what he did to women and how he manipulated them. But what the fuck were the, I just would think, what are these men just standing around, like unaware, with their fucking just chin up to the sky, not paying any attention? But what you pointed out, which I didn't know, was that there was this there was like a men's only group that sort of preached very men's rightsy red pill stuff, right? So they're not they're not oblivious. They're just like, this is how we're supposed to treat women, right?
Right, because this is the way Keith tells them, the Vanguard tells them, women need to be treated for their own good.
Right.
And, you know, why they listened, I don't know. But
well, I mean, if it benefit, I mean, ostensibly benefits them, they have people that are subservient to them. And, you know, it's this weird thing of like, a cult leader can make you become a slave or a master or anything in between. It's like, you're just going to fucking listen. Because that's your life now, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm curious as to, I mean, you went to every trial that you could, all the court stuff. The evolution of the believers, the core believers, the most believer believers that there are who actually had to plead guilty to get out of any potential jail time. How much of that do you, in your eyes, so many of them you did know, how much of that do you think is bullshit, them just trying to get out of trouble, or do you think it's that they've actually come around and realized the dementedness of this guy that they dedicated so much of their life to? Which one? What do you see when you see them do that?
I think Nancy Salzman in particular just pled out, not because she feels, I don't think she's capable of feeling too much either. She did it just so that she could get first one out and the best deal. Lauren Salzman, her daughter, who it was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking to watch her testify what has happened to her life. And I think that she did believe him. I think I don't think she had any outs. She had her two, the two people that she turned to for advice were Nancy and Keith. Where do you go in your 20s when those are your role models? I mean, they turned her into a machine. She just, you know, it was heartbreaking. But I do believe that she believed that what she was doing was right, as horrible as the things were that she was doing. And that's where I go back into that. You know, we don't have a place for people like that.
Yeah.
That girl doesn't belong in prison.
Right.
But she has to pay for what she did.
Right.
So where does she go? What do you do with someone like that? You know, how do you find the right place? I can't honestly speak to Allison. I didn't see her. I saw her allocution. I don't know enough about her that I would feel comfortable really making a statement. Although, just hearing some of the things, I have more passion for Lauren than I did anyone else because she was just there so long. And she had no other resources.
And it was her mom. I mean, her mom was the prefect. I mean, how do you leave that? It's your mom. Right. It's literally your mother. It's not someone you know or used to trust. It's like, what are you going to do? Yeah.
And I was there when, you know, before Nancy became the prefect. And all Lauren really wanted was her mother to pay attention to her. She was just looking for a mom to pay attention to her. I saw that even before this all started.
Yeah.
So when Nancy started to pay attention to her because she was doing the coaching, and her dad, because I wondered about what happened with her dad, but it came out in the trial that they, you know, they had something on Michael as well. So it's how they control people to not speak out, to not go public with things. And you just, you know, you keep your head down. You hope it's going to go away.
Yeah.
But, and Claire Brofman, I don't know, you know,
yeah, who knows, yeah.
I just think that there's absolutely no way that she was not aware of what she was doing. She's perjured herself so many times in testimony that it's a joke and that nothing ever is done. It's just money.
Yeah. You know? And she still has all the money in the world to protect herself, right? I mean, she's not broke. Yeah. Okay.
No, she's not broke. And not to the best of my knowledge, she's not broke. And I think it's going to take a lot to break her.
Yeah.
I hope that she does go to a maximum security or a federal prison. I think it's something like, I think the judge said if he gives her over 27 months, that she can appeal it. Because she pled. So it's what are those charges? And it's back to the same thing, but it's the opposite. So when the judge took the allocutions of, let's say, Nancy Salzman, and she pled to the charges that she did, and then later he learned how much influence she had, how much influence Claire had, you know, what was the manipulation that was going on, the coercion, you know, sadly, can he take any of that into consideration?
Right.
We're going back to that letter of the law thing.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think even 27 months in a federal prison for someone like Claire Brofman, who sits in wait in her, I don't know, something like $10,000 a month apartment in Manhattan somewhere, in home confinement.
Yeah.
I hope it's horrible for her.
Yeah. I mean, the bills she paid for really, I mean, that you could draw a direct line as to that was the ultimate source of the pain that anyone involved in NXIVM was able to create was really, I mean, it was out of her wallet, you know, it wasn't, yeah. There's no mystery there, you know, I mean, if you have enough money, you can keep going. And that was all her money. Yeah.
I had two people tell me to my face that they were offered $1 million to get me indicted. Two different people.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is just so fucking extreme. That is so extreme. I mean, you knew Keith extremely well. Do you, and I'm assuming I know the answer, but I have to ask, do you sense like any remorse or regret or any natural human feeling in the wake of all of this from him? I know you haven't talked to him, but I know you've seen him a lot just at the court and everything. Is there anything from the man that you know, or even back then? I mean, was it always clear in retrospect that this was a sociopath, or was this something that became clear and now you look at him and it's just dead eyes 24/7? Like, is there a human in there?
No.
No.
I mean, and I say that so quickly.
Yeah.
I didn't miss 1 second of that trial. I think I only missed a couple of the hearings. After 20 years of him basically trying to blow up my life and the life of my family and my child and my friends and anyone that came into contact with me, you know, finally he was where he needed to be. All I wanted was to see the law used the way it's supposed to be used, for him to be held accountable in the court of law, with the place that they use to abuse people for decades. And when the jury was charged, the day that they read the charge, I was one of the only people in the courtroom, because to the rest of the world, that was boring. They didn't want to hear the charges. It was myself and a couple of sketch artists. That was it. And it took the full day. And I watched him, and I watched that jury. And I knew that they were going to come back.
Yeah.
There was no way. And when they had 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours, and they had lunch, they were back with the verdict. And his reaction was like he shrugged, like it was like I really think he thought he was going to get away with it.
Yeah, I mean, that is fucking wild. But I think it really, really, really underscores who the guy is, which is that there's no actual human there. He just gets away with things. He's always been able to. He pulls what he needs to, as sociopaths do, and uses the information almost reflexively, automatically, to manipulate and get what he wants.
Yes.
I'm assuming he just thought that the jury would agree with everyone else in his life, who usually does appear to agree with him and let him do what he wants, you know?
Yep. Yeah. It's worked. I mean, for all these years, Matt, it's worked with everyone on every level. And he sat across from those jurors, and I'd watch him, you know, I'd laugh because I'd watch him try to connect with jurors and do different things, his NLP skills. And I would laugh because it's not going to happen. They hate you.
Yeah.
You're disgusting. One of the most disturbing things for me during the trial was when they were proving through photographs a lot of things, and they were proving that he had photographs of a 15-year-old, pornographic photographs. And there was I don't know, 8 or 10 or 11 or so photos of different women in his inner circle that he had photos of also. And the government found them hidden in a file on his computer, and they were all under their nicknames. So the way that they proved that was they had emails that proved that those were the nicknames he used and that they accepted it, and they went through that. And the girl was 15 at the time. And at 15, he has a photograph of her. Now all the other women in the photos are also positioned in the same place, way. He has a look, apparently. Mm. And she doesn't have any scars on her body. At 16, she has appendicitis. So she has a scar from the appendicitis. And in her 20s, when she's branded, she has the brand.
Oh, God.
And what disturbed me was he got to watch and look at all these photos because it was the only time that I saw any emotion from him, as he would kind of like pull into the computer screen to get a better, closer look. And I was watching him, and I was watching the jurors watch him. And I thought I was the only one disgusted. Mm. But there wasn't anyone in the room that saw that wasn't disgusted by it, because you could see the pleasure he was getting out of it. Or when they'd show videos of him, the first video that came up that he was in the library, he started to point to the computer screen and to his attorney, like, oh, look, that's my hot tub. That's my library.
Whoa.
He's just so delusional. Just so, he thinks that everything he's doing is okay.
Wow. What a fucking crazy person. Yeah. I mean, every once in a while you run into people like this. Rarely are they the leader of some group and allowed the opportunity to reach their, as he would put it, fully integrate, but really to just reach their full dementedness. I mean, every once in a while I'll come across someone and think, that's just someone who to absolutely avoid no matter what, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
I like to think I would peg Keith as that, but who the fuck knows? But rarely do they actually get a foothold to be able to step all the way into what their full madman sort of form is. You know, they don't have enough money, or they don't have enough people that give a shit, or they don't have enough success, or whatever it is. I mean, Keith, it was like a strange, perfect confluence of things. I mean, if he hadn't met people who would be that sort of army, even his early army, none of it would have happened. Those enablers, you know, there's so many steps along the way. If he never met Nancy, if he never da da da, but this is a case where that would be madman stepped into all of the things that allowed him to be, you know, and it's just, it's remarkable how long he got to be that. And I'm curious for you, on the other end of all of this, I mean, you talk about it a little bit in your book, but now that we're, you know, looking like we're going to wrap up soon, I want to know sort of where, because you've been on this not by choice at first. I mean, you were just sort of fending for your life as he's trying to put you underwater with all these lawsuits and this crazy shit. But how do you move on from this, but how are you feeling now with him getting what he deserves, and now your life is sort of free now finally? But I would imagine the real sort of relief is that he is gone from the world.
Right. Yes. You know, the last thing Keith said to me was, the next time I see you, you'll be dead or in jail.
Right.
And he was half right. Yeah. He was in jail.
Yeah. You got the jail part right. Yeah.
Yeah, you got the jail part right, Keith. You're not as smart as you said either. And when he was arrested, he was suing me in the state of Washington and trying to have me extradited into Mexico for unfalse charges. Huh. So there wasn't really, you know, there's only so much you can explain in the book where people's heads start to still tilt.
Yeah.
And then once he was arrested, it was putting together the information that I had to give to the government. So a lot of the basics, so many people say to me, you know, the details, how did you get these details?
Yeah.
20 years of documents and boxes and things and putting them together, not for the purpose of writing a book, but for the purpose of giving them to somebody that can actually finally do something with them.
Right.
And, you know, that was that process of my life. And then the trial came, and I didn't miss any of the trial because from a healing point, it was important for me to be able to see that through. But when you have PTSD, just because the person that started that or caused that or helped perpetuate that is gone, that doesn't dissipate from your body.
Right.
So it just takes time, and it takes time to heal and processing, you know, what's going on. His sentencing is January 17th, and I'll be there to watch him go away for the last time, because I think that's going to probably be about it for him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's definitely he's got to go away for the rest of his life at this point. How old is
he? There's still, he's 58.
Okay.
He's 58 or 59 now. 58 or 59. There's two charges. There's child pornography and I think child pornography and exploitation of a child. Those are predicate acts in the Eastern District. They were tossed to the Northern District because of jurisdiction. But it doesn't look like, you know, I think they're waiting to see if he gets 40 years, let's say.
Right, if it's necessary to go forth with that stuff. Yeah, so what were the charges that he was ultimately found guilty on? I read it was seven charges, right?
Yes, exploitation of, I don't have the list in front of me, yes, I do. Racketeering, conspiracy, racketeering, forced labor, wire fraud, sex trafficking,
it's like his final, the final resume that he actually deserves. That's it.
Yeah. He's, not everything that he should have been charged with, but enough to put him away.
Right.
For the rest of his life. There's a reason for prisons for people like that.
Yeah.
Someone like Keith should not be exposed to the world, ever again. Yet he's been caught with two cell phones. So who's he calling?
Yeah. I was going to say, do you think he's just sitting there thinking, he must be sitting there thinking, I can't believe I'm being persecuted like this. This is all, this is one big smear campaign because they don't want, it's crazy. There's no way he's not doing that. What a fucking crazy guy. Yeah.
Right. He's never made a mistake in his life. It's always somebody else's fault. And if you ever want to know what he's doing, or anyone that's still left of his inner circle, or anyone that's still propagating or pretending, all you have to do is see what are they claiming, or whatever he would say you were doing, I would tell authorities or attorneys or whoever I was talking to, that's what he's doing.
Right.
He mimics, he mirrors exactly what he's doing. It's almost like he can't stand that he has a secret and he has to tell. That's how you know what's going on.
I mean, that might be the most human thing about him, because that's something people do a lot. It's just like the ultimate psychopath version of it, because it's endless and so, it's so true all the time, nonstop with him, that it's just like, it's almost automatic, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, fuck. I mean, I'm definitely gonna be paying attention to the sentencing. I mean, that feels like it'll be the final part of this story, and hopefully everyone touched by him can sort of move on with their life without having to worry about that fucking piece of
shit.
Yeah,
I think that this judge was excellent. He was amazing and compassionate, but held a strong court. No one really was, there weren't any, he was given every opportunity to get what he was duly entitled to.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that there was any lost opportunity there.
Yeah.
But he'll appeal. I mean, that's what they do. They
right,
appeal.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think he's out of gas at this point. I mean, he's a notorious pedophile cult leader now to the entire world, And I don't think that's, he's got nothing. I mean, he's fucked. And finally, thankfully, he's fucked.
Right. Finally.
Yeah. Well, it's been about an hour and a half, Tony. I really appreciate your time. Is there anything you want to share with my audience before we jump off here?
Anyone that's looking for more information, we have a website called The Fall of Nexium. We're going to be, we put up documents and looking for people that are looking to tell their story or need support. We're going to be collecting and helping. You know, I was watching the news the other day and they said that there's an epidemic of loneliness out there.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I heard that, it scared me because I thought, oh, that like opens the door for somebody like Keith.
I know. I think about that too. I really do. Yeah.
It's frightening. So, you know, how do you see those flags and where do you go to get the information? And if for people that want to, we're going to put up a section that are documents and legal briefs and things so that people have a better understanding of what happened and what to look out for.
Yeah.
What flags to look out for and how to be wary for themselves, their children.
Yeah, that's just so important. I think that's great. What's the website again?
It's thefallofnexium.com.
Thefallofnexium.com.
Thefallofnexium. Cool. And then there's always Rick Ross, who's an amazing resource for people.
Right. And your book is out, and it's called The Program. And
The Program.
Everyone should read it. I read it. It blew my mind. We covered some of it here, but not nearly all of it. So definitely, if this interested you, check it out because it's a really, really amazing book. And Tony, thank you for writing it, for sharing it with the world, and thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And let's be in touch.
Matt, thank you for reaching out. It really meant a lot to me. It really did. Okay. I appreciate your time.
Great. Yeah, likewise. Okay, I'll talk to you soon, Tony. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.